Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're filing this program from the stormy, freezing cold, snowy Northeast. Although our show today is not particularly wintry, is it?
Well, sort of. In a way, it is, I guess, because the second track actually takes place around Lent, which usually begins in winter. So that's a little wintry, especially since that recording's coming to us from Chicago. But Diana Kennedy, who kicks off today's program, is a very smart lady. She's in southern Mexico.
She's in central Mexico.
Where the sun's shining.
In eternal sunshine. But she herself has the personality of sunshine. So it's a delight to actually listen to her talk about her favorite recipes and her current book, which is an updated version of her older book called Nothing Fancy.
Yeah, it's amazing to think of the fact that she's made lots of books, but she got around to redoing one that was done 25 years ago, probably, and it's not coming out until April in the bookstores, but put in a check on your calendar to make sure that you get to our website right around the beginning of April so you can order your own copy of a fascinating life story as well as a fascinating cookbook. Listeners, you're in for a real treat because we're talking to one of the best known, best loved perpetrators of the art of cooking the cuisine of a foreign land that you can possibly imagine. Welcome to the program for, I think, the second time, Diana Kennedy, calling us on a telephone line provided by the famous Mexican telephone company Taco Bell.
It might as well be for the service they give me, yes. For the, owned by the richest man in the world is quite an insult.
Well, didn't they just take some of his money away?
Are you kidding?
I thought they took away part of his business and
no!
said he couldn't have it all.
He's a skinflint.
This is Mr. Slim, right?
Yeah.
What a nasty Carlos Slim. What a nasty name.
He's not very slim either.
but seriously, listeners, Diana Kennedy just admitted that she was born in the year of our Lord, 1923, on March
1923.
Yeah, in March 3rd, which is our grandson's birthday. He's going to turn 7. I'm not even going to try the arithmetic. We're just going to forget. You're probably not even counting anymore, are you?
No, that's the thing. When people ask me if my birthday and come to have a party, I say, what the birthday? I've stopped counting because, you know, at this age, it's all the same. You look the same, you sort of, so there's, except, and I don't think my cooking's improved. I'm so tired of my own food.
You are?
Well, we asked you this question before, I'm sure, but let's do it again anyway, because I'm always reminded of thinking about you when we talked to Anne Willen, who I'm sure must be a good friend of yours.
Yes, yes.
And we asked her what in her right mind was going through her mind when she decided that she should open a cooking school in Paris run by an English woman.
And I know how brave she was. And of course, for them, it's very tenacious, and she's really made this a marvelous thing out of this, cordon bleu.
But you did the same thing. I mean, you're from Essex on the border of Epping Forest, and yet you decided that you would be an expert on the obscure cuisine of Mexico, from all the things that are in Taco Bell.
Well, no, actually, I didn't decide anything. I could say that a lo lirico, as would say, I took an interest in food the minute I came here, because I think from Nothing Fancy you can see that I always loved to eat and loved to cook, and then so find all these wonderful things in the market and decided I would cook them. And it was really, we have to blame and praise Craig Claiborne for pushing me into it professionally. When I was in New York, very much alone, my husband had just died, didn't know anybody, and it was he who said, you have to give Mexican cooking lessons, because I had been so interested and started collecting recipes in Mexico, and he knew that because he visited us. So really it was Craig who started so many of us off on our careers of cooking, and I think he's never given enough credit for what he did.
Now, so in a way, your background in going to Mexico is a little bit like Julia Child going to France, because
yes.
Because she ended up there because her husband was there, and I'm guessing that the same misfortune happened to you.
No, it didn't really happen like that. I was, as you know, met my husband in the revolution in Haiti, and he was a New York Times correspondent, said, why don't you come back? So, you know, I didn't have a well-established diplomatic husband like Julia. She had a very interesting setup when she got there, but Paul had been, you know, wandering around sort of, I think, with a girl in every port, and it just happened that there's a huge spider that just jumped off the counter. My house is very ecological.
I understand it's sometimes without power too. I was just reading the section
now it's okay.
Now it's okay.
Now we have a very good system, and if it does go out, I do have a generator. So, but then we have to, start switching wires around and things like that. Mind you, it's not easy. It's living in the country with all the things that the country brings. It has its many benefits, from wonderfully fresh air and garden things, organics and all that sort of thing. So, I mean, there are, sometimes you're in despair and think, oh my God, I can't stand it any longer.
Right.
And then you suddenly realize what you have.
Now, we're talking today because we just received an advanced copy of a new old book. So,
yes.
So for those people who have not been familiar with your work, you've written a number of books, but one of the early ones was called Nothing Fancy, and for reasons which I'm going to ask you to explain, you decided it was time to update Nothing Fancy and produce a whole new edition. Perhaps you can explain why.
Yeah, well, it's so, my wonderful editor through all these years, Fran McCullough, she's a wonderful researcher, a terrific editor, suggested it, because you can't let old books die, because in a way they're historic. There are all sorts of new things and newfangled ideas, but we still need to have a history of family food. It's very, very important. And maybe a few of the recipes will ring a bell in older people like me. And if not, just enjoy my very acerbic comments on some of the ridiculous things that go on in the food world.
Well, I love it. I absolutely love that. I just started reading the chapter called Bête Noire.
I
want to spend a few minutes on that because I think it's so hilarious.
It is hilarious.
So fire away about some of those things that...
You hate. You can't tolerate.
That everyone should hate, I think, is what you're saying.
Yes. Well, it's just silly what people put up with, and of course people do. And unfortunately, I've always been designed as a rebel and difficult. They say, oh my God, she's so difficult. And I don't think if I were difficult, I would have the same editor over all these years and work for the same photographers, etc., etc. But I do think we need to poke fun at some of the ridiculous things that go on in the kitchen and in printing.
So give our listeners some examples of perhaps some of the more outrageous ones.
Oh, a silly one.
A silly one, okay.
A silly one. I will not be called dear by the waiter. This happened in a very posh place with a very distinguished lady, and she was very thought I was so silly, but I object to being called dear. I'm not the waiter's old auntie. I'm a paying customer, and with many years of cooking and a restaurant going all over the world, and so I won't be called dear.
But
you have to do it with a laugh. You know, all these things I do with a laugh, except the things about the waste in kitchens, which I really take very seriously.
Now, you don't like canola oil.
You don't like what?
You don't like canola oil because you say there's no such thing as a canola.
Yeah. Canola. Yeah, and this kosher salt bit.
Yeah, I see that one too.
I was so relieved when Mark Bittman, now it's not Bittman, Bittman.
Yeah, Bittman.
Came out with this book on salt, and the things he says about kosher salt, I said, oh my God, somebody is now put into words which I never knew. You just hate the damn stuff. And every editor and every cook wants to do this damn kosher salt.
Now, here's
so read his. I give him two quotes from Mark's wonderful book on salt.
Now, I'm worried about high tea. I'm worried that you're attacking one of the most famous things about English cuisine, and most people don't even know what high tea is anyway.
High tea in the kitchen is afternoon tea. You know, afternoon tea, which is a great, wonderful thing to stop you getting drunk before your second martini, and all those delicate things, wonderful pastries and stuff that there's a great art in making. I still stick to my afternoon tea here in Mexico.
And I let's close with this one, because this brings back visions of the first President Bush. But raw broccoli and cauliflower in dips or salads, and you say, a cow has four stomachs to digest them, we haven't.
I know. Well, it's true. You have these dips. Now, I adore broccoli, as against Senior Bush, you can't stand it. But you have to cook it right. And the person who told me, Peter Kump had been going to Marcella Hazan's Italian classes. I couldn't afford it, and I was working, so I couldn't go. And he said, Dana, this is the way to cook broccoli. And, you know, then cut off all the stems, but use them. Took off the hard parts, cut them into julienne strips, so that they cook the same time as the flour. And so you don't get, and, you know, these people who turn up with a whole stem and all the flour and microwaves. I mean, it's just awful. All you have to do is blanch it and cook it enough, and then toss it in olive oil and garlic, and it's sublime, and it's a dish of its own. But one of the things, I don't know whether I said, but the most difficult thing to teach cooks of any age, especially now, or commonly students, is the difference between raw and I'm getting a blank now. Oh dear. Al dente.
There we go.
Raw and al dente. Lots of people don't know it. I mean, they send out all this raw stuff. And again, you know, it's very gassy apart from anything else.
Now, it turns out the book just fell open to page 64. And what should be on page 64 but British-style roast potatoes?
Oh, nothing like them.
Go ahead, Diana. Wave the good old Union Jack here and tell us these are the world's best potatoes. Go ahead.
Well, the thing is that everybody, you know, has been to the French class or something and just tosses potatoes in whatever. I use goose fat or duck fat. And then they're sort of toughish and things. The whole trick is to cook, par cook, so that you soften the outside and that'll absorb your oils and get this lovely, crusty outside. And it's just, I don't think anybody who was brought up in England appreciates this. It's a meal in itself, and it's wonderfully delicious, and fattening and everything else, but what the hell?
Yeah, we just spent Christmas with my brother, who does all the cooking in his house, and he does masterful British roast potatoes, right, sweetheart?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, good.
So
they're really special.
Yeah, so we had them at every meal, and our clothes were distinctly tighter on the way home than they were on the way over. But the subject of the book is mostly the country cooking of Mexico.
There
aren't many recipes that I've Mexicanized or British. The Mexican recipes, just a few I've tucked in there.
Yes.
People don't know.
But these are the things that you like to cook, your favorites, for your favorite people.
Oh, yes. I mean, we're all inspired by some of this. Now, let's say there are far too many cookbooks written and published. There are far too many Mexican ones, terrible ones just come out by five. It's a shocking book. There are far too many.
But
going through it, I mean, you just, and I love, as you know, Paula Wolfert's, especially her Eastern Mediterranean book and the French. And these things, a recipe just sings out. And when you've got this massive of spinach in the garden, you know, you want something exotic. You just don't want cooked spinach. And that's where I come in and dig through my favorite books and use their recipes for the abundance in my garden.
Now I just dropped the book again on the floor and opened it up where it fell, and I'm on page 108. And on page 108 is a recipe I'm going to make very soon because I promised the local dining critic with the local magazine that I would cook him tongue because he said he liked tongue. And the recipe here is corned tongue.
Oh, it's divine. I've got some at the moment. And I could sit and eat a whole pound and a quarter. I don't because of the salt beater in it. It's divine. Now, I don't know why in the States in particular, unless their mothers were very bad cooks and cooked tongue, they cannot eat tongue. Tongue to me is the great joy of an animal, you know, and especially when corned. If you don't like it just ordinarily cooked, or a la vera cruzana, which is great, then try corning it. And it's just so delicious. Corned ham and tongue were our sort of high tea things when I was young and growing up. And I tell you, it's addictive. I was perfectly addictive.
Yeah, well, you make one. When I make it, I make three. I go to my local specialty butcher who buys his meat locally, and I say, "Do you have any tongues?" And when he has three, it's time for me to cook tongue. And the wonderful part about it is that he sells them for $5 a piece. It's really quite amazing. But I was also using this as a segue towards one of your stories.
Can I just say, it's the most expensive meat here in the States and in Mexico.
Yes.
Because I tell you what, in many parts of Mexico, they barbecue in a pit, not on the thing, the whole head, so you can't get the tongue.
Got it.
To battle to get the tongue.
Well, now tell
okay,
our,
what's my favorite story, your favorite story?
Tell our listeners the saltpeter story. You needed saltpeter, and you went to buy some at the shop, and he said he didn't have any, and you went the next day, and he didn't have any.
Oh, the cow's head. It's the head of the little calf, isn't it? The calf's head, galantine.
What I thought was funny was the way you described the fact that you asked him and he said he didn't have any, but he would get some.
Yes.
And then you went back the next day and he still didn't have any, and then he went back the next day and he didn't have any. And then about 2 weeks later he went back and he said he'd had it all the time.
Oh, no, he'd just been to Mexico City to inspect some, he was some sort of inspector, and he'd just been to Mexico City to inspect some slaughterhouses, and he found that nobody was taking notice of these little veal tongues, veal heads, so he brought them back for me. And it's delicious, absolutely delicious.
Do you want to pick a couple of your favorites here, Diane, and walk our listeners through them before we close?
Oh, yes. That recipe for hot cross buns, by the way, is Kent and the Flower Advisory Board in the 60s or in the 50s. And it's one of the great hot cross bun recipes. I know you'll scream because you have to let it reposar or stand for on three occasions. But it is one of the things. And I do love British starch. I mean, oh, and you've got to read the story about the crumpet. That's a funny one, too.
I haven't seen a crumpet for years and years and years. We used to cook them at Cambridge when I was there. We used to have a meal in the afternoon of crumpets toasted on a gas fire with butter and jam.
Yes.
In order to make it to dinner time. And you don't see them anymore.
But you see, nobody made crumpets in those days. You always bought them. So I was determined to make them. Now, muffins. Let's take something of muffins. Nobody in England eats English muffins anymore. The Americans have cakey things they call muffins. So that, again, I think I devised that recipe. I'm not sure. And the trick is to put a little bit of that of mashed potato in with the dough.
Oh, wow.
It's another element that keeps it moist. So, I mean, I do love those British gooey things.
Well, you interject enough of your personality into your cooking, your recipes, to make it very personal Mexican.
So listeners, what you've got to do is you've got to mark your calendar for around about the 1st of April, because this book's going to come out shortly thereafter, and I'm sure at that time you can put it on order at Amazon, and you'll have something to while away the evening just to read about Diana Kennedy's fascinating life story in Mexico. It really is most entertaining, and by the way, there just happen to be some brilliant recipes as well. Thank you so much for joining us today, Diana. We wish you well. We wish you a long and healthy life continuing, and be in touch, please, when you have another book out.
Well, that's absolutely wonderful to talk to you, and I do hope people will laugh about my memoir and remember that all that plastic bags and all that awful sous vide stuff people are doing.
Oh dear, we better not start on another subject, otherwise we'll never get off the air.
No, I know.
Diana.
We'll have a sous vide conversation. I am eloquent about it. Good. Lovely to talk to you both.
You too.
And then get better, Anne.
Yes, I hope so too. Bye-bye, Diana.
This lady is some kind of dynamo. Born on March 3rd, 1923. Hard to believe. And she's still going strong and still as entertaining as ever. And, of course, we're entertaining her as we always do. And we'll be right back after this break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Whatever could be wrong with a company or a business called Delightful Pastries, this business in Chicago? Well, one of the things that could be difficult is as we talked to Dobra, the owner and pastry chef, having to make 40,000 of these things called pasties.
The most amazing thing, and starting off the interview, a fascinating explanation of why it is that in Poland you don't celebrate Ash Tuesday. You celebrate it 2 days before or 2 days after, and you do it twice. It's a really fascinating story, and a little bit of how Poland got to Chicago. The first question we have for our next guest, Dobra Bielinski, is how come Poland, her native land, double dips on Fat Tuesday and also has a Fat Thursday?
Well, that goes back to the Middle Ages when one of the kings of Poland decided to have fat parties. Basically, all the food was fried, and the tradition ensued from there that they had a big party on Fat Thursday, and all the food that they ate was deep fried. The other legend goes back a century later and states that there was a terrible mayor of the city who was very vicious to the women in the square where they would sell their wares. And on his death, which was the Thursday before Ash Wednesday, he died, and they had a huge celebration. So each year after his death, there was a huge party in the square with fried food. So they were remembering his death because they really wanted to show off that he will no longer be bothering anybody.
Now, which was the Tuesday and which was the Thursday? I think we got those mixed up.
They both were on Thursday.
Oh, okay.
So
all right.
Actually, in Poland, nobody celebrates Fat Tuesdays except Polish Americans. Polish Americans celebrate the Thursday and the Tuesday. But in Poland, on Fat Tuesday, they eat pickled herring and rye bread.
Now, the reason that we're talking about this is might have been obscure so far, but it turns out that Dobra and her family, right, Dobra? Own a pastry business called Delightful Pastries. And the city of Chicago, you have more than one delightful pastry location. So,
yes, we do.
So I'm guessing this is kind of a big time of the year for being in the pastry business. Okay, Dobra, so now we've established that Poland is selfish and has two equivalents of Fat Tuesday, but what kinds of things are celebrated on those 2 days?
Typically in Poland on Fat Thursday, we the Poles double dip. So we eat pączki and we eat faworki, which are kind of jelly-filled donuts that are glazed, and you have sprinkles of candied orange peel on top. And then faworki or chrust, depending on which part of Poland you live in, are little crispy pieces of dough that you deep fry, and then you put powdered sugar on top. And the reason why you eat this type of food is typically Lent would start and there would be no eggs and no eating of lard, and you wanted to finish up all your lard, finish up all your eggs, because both the doughs and both products are very egg-rich products.
Sure. It's interesting. In England, where I grew up, the Tuesday before Ash Wednesday is called a Shrove Tuesday. You always traditionally make pancakes. What here in the United States they call flapjacks, and what the French would call crepes. And I recall my mother saying that tradition had to do with using the last of the flour, but it also might have been using the last of the eggs, since both Poland and England in the medieval era had probably very similar agricultural and social systems. So it's probably exactly the same kind of thing,
yeah.
Except I'm guessing
Lent was big.
Yeah, and I'm
Lent was really big in all of Europe. You know, it was you really fasted for those 40 days. You really deprived yourself of meat. You know, the monasteries provided people with fish, and everybody every Friday was expected to eat fish. So you know, they had smoked fish, fried fish. You know. All kinds of fish soups, you know, you think of bouillabaisse in France, you think of fish stew up in England, you know. So we smoked fish in Poland, we eat a lot of smoked fish, so all that stuff kind of, you know, the religion kind of dictated the food to some extent.
Yeah, it's funny. We have this feeling that the explanation might be more sinister than that, and that in fact what was happening is the meat that had been killed and preserved in the fall was now starting to run out. But rather than the church acknowledging that the problem was there wasn't enough, what they did instead was to say, well, even if you had any, you wouldn't be able to use it, because there's a reason there's a reason that you're not indulging in this during Lent,
yeah,
which is a religious purpose. But
think about it. You know, eggs, you could still have eggs because, you know, you still have chickens that you'd feed that still bring eggs, but you would not be eating them.
Yeah.
So I think part of it, I think, has a health implication, you know, that fasting for a little bit is really good for you. And especially, like, you know, medieval times, the food was really heavy. I mean, I've read some recipes from the 17th and 18th century England, you know, of what was served for dinners of various nobles. And, I mean, it's 30, 40 courses. And, I mean, you just read the recipes for cheesecake. It's like 5 pounds of cheese, 40 eggs. The stuff was really, it was really rich. So I think the kind of rich, heavy diet that they had, mm-hmm. since there's not a lot of vegetables except for the root vegetables and the pickled stuff that was left over in the winter, you know, it was actually good for people to kind of fast because they're eating all this preserved and heavy food all winter long.
Now, I'm going to don't think that the next question I'm going to ask you is redundant. Bear in mind that on the menu is heard all around the world. And the rest of the world doesn't necessarily know that a sizable segment of the population in Chicago, where you now live and where the Delightful Pastries business is, a lot of people from Poland migrated there,
yeah,
in the 19th and 20th
That's
centuries. But
mm-hmm.
So I sort of answered the question in a way, but why is it, do you think, that these Polish delicacies have caught on across the Chicago community?
I think, you know, the sizable Polish population, which you said, and it's really delicious. You know, it's, who can say no to a rose petal or a plum butter filled, you know, ponchek that's been glazed, that glaze has lemon oil or orange oil in it with little candied orange peel. I mean, it's just so delicious. I think delicious food always transcends cultures. You know, just like we all love crepe, croissant. You know, you can eat a croissant from Paris to Shanghai to Chicago to Tokyo. You know, some delicacies just transcend. And the fact that there's a huge Polish population, you know, just kind of amplifies it. So you have a delicious food that you eat only a certain time of the year, and then you have this big population that eats that thing a certain time of the year. So when you combine the two, Chicago is very heavily Roman Catholic. You know, we have a lot of Swedes here. We have a lot of Germans. We have a lot of Latinos. So it's, you know, Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday, it's really popular because of the huge Roman Catholic population in Chicago as well.
I got you. Now, it's really funny. We were just interviewing someone the other day, and we were talking about English muffins. And the curious thing, it sort of goes like this, I think. Nobody in England eats English muffins anymore. only Americans eat English muffins, and they're probably made by Thomas's, and they're frozen. That's the point. They wouldn't catch on in Chicago, regardless of Fat Tuesday or anything else, because they're really not very delicious. And the secret is, you have to be delicious. Now, I want to do a little bit of your family's history, because how you got to own a business in Chicago catering to the Polish and other sweet tooth community called Delightful Pastries. It wasn't a straightforward thing, was it? It wasn't that somebody one day got on a boat in Warsaw and got off at the other end in Chicago and started cooking.
No, well, you know, we lived in Poland, then my parents moved to Austria right before martial law got instated. And then my dad got a job offer with Siemens Corporation in South Africa. So we moved to Southern Africa. And then, you know, the political situation in South Africa got very kind of difficult, and some friends of ours moved to Chicago, and they told us we should move here. So that's kind of how we landed up in Chicago, because some friends of ours from South Africa recommended it in the Polish community. The reason why I opened up the bakery is I was actually studying to, in graduate school, I did U.S. foreign policy in Latin America, and I studied a year abroad, and I was in Paris, and I loved all the pâtisserie, the boulangerie, all the macarons, the croissant, the baguettes, you know. It was, to me, it was just delicious. So when I came back, I finished my degrees, and I enrolled in culinary school, and I said, I really want to, I've been baking since I was 9 years old. When I lived in Austria, there was this wonderful sculptress, Teresa, who lived in our building, and she said every young Fräulein needs to learn how to bake, embroider, and recite Austrian poetry. So ergo, you know, I learned to bake at a very early age, and that got me hooked. I was in South Africa. I would bake, you know, cakes. That's how I made my extra money. I would bake for people in the community. I'd be making all kinds of things. So, you know, I always had the love for baking, but when I studied abroad at the Sorbonne in Paris for a year, that really underscored everything, you know, that I already loved. And I just said, I've got to make these wonderful croissants. I have to make these wonderful macarons. I love to bake all these wonderful, delicious goodies.
Isn't there a very special kind of cake that's made in South Africa?
You know what? In South Africa, it's a very English, you know, it's a very English cuisine. So there's a lot of fruit cakes. There's also a lot of Portuguese. So the biggest influencers of food in Southern Africa are the Brits and the Portuguese. So there's a lot of like milk tarts. It's a very popular South African cake. You know, so it's basically a custard, and then it's a puff pastry, and you bake it together. That's you know, so you think of it, you know, kind of, it's a very popular item. They call it melktert, you know, in Afrikaans. So that's a very popular item. A lot of puddings, a lot of puddings, you know.
Now, do you make those too?
No, you know, there's not a lot of, South Africans living in Chicago, so there's not a huge call for that. We do a lot of tiramisu, we do sourdough bread, we do croissant, we do our ponchki, you know, so there's a lot of things we make that are very kind of international, but, South African pastries are not, you know, there's also a lot of guava, so there's a lot of, guava jams and guava candies in South Africa as well. That's another big popular item.
Now, let's give this some scale, because it's up until now, this has kind of sounded like a small home-based operation, but it sure isn't anything like that. So let's give some scale. First of all, you don't have just one pastry shop, you have more than one.
You have three locations, one in West Loop, one in Old Town, and one in Jefferson Park. That's the one we started in.
Okay, so that's the first. Now, Jefferson Park, I'm not so familiar with it. What cardinal direction is that out of the center?
So that's northwest side of Chicago.
Okay, got it. So it's heading out towards Lincoln Park?
That's actually north of Lincoln Park.
Oh, that's
northwest.
Okay.
When you're going towards the airport.
Okay. And then the West Loop is a section which seems to be restaurant heaven these days.
Yes, it is. So we're on Randolph and Clinton.
Okay, but that's heading directly due west from mm-hmm. the downtown loop itself.
Yeah, that's correct.
And it seems we were in Chicago for the James Beard Awards last May, the first time it had ever been held outside of New York, and several of the restaurants that were doing special events were in this mm-hmm. West Loop section.
Blackboard, Avac over there,
you got
Girl and the Goat, so the Oshawa, all these wonderful restaurants right down on Randolph Street.
Now, do you manage to place any of your pastries on their menus?
You know what? All those places that I mentioned, they actually make all their pastries in the house.
Oh, they do.
None of them outsource.
Well,
yeah, unfortunately, none of them outsource anything.
Well, now they're not very smart, because you not only have three outlets, you do these things on scale, right?
I mean, yes, I do.
About how many pashkis are you going to be making
start? We're going to do about between 40 and 50,000 of the week of, you know, the last few days before Lent starts. It's going to be frying all day, all night. The fryer doesn't even get turned off. We're just frying nonstop.
Now, do people keep on ordering them through Lent, or is it?
Yes. You know what? We make ponchki all year round. But, you know, the last few weeks of Carnival, that's when they're the most popular. But during the summertime when we do farmers markets, that's a big popular item on our menu. We bring the punchki to the farmers market.
Oh, there you go. So people can have a taste for them. It's a year-round kind of thing. And and I think we might have talked about this before, but when people come in and buy, how many do they buy at a time? Do they buy like 6 or 12, or is it like donuts?
You know what? Some people buy in a couple because it's just for themselves. And a lot of people tend to work and, you know, for their family, so they buy, you know, 2-3 dozen. And some people buy some, and then they come back because they said, everybody ate them and I have nothing left to take home. So some people I see 2-3 times back, coming back, you know, the same day because they ran out.
It's sort of like the cupcake craze in New York City, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not a big fan of cupcakes.
I don't think I'm a big fan of them either, but there's one on 6th Avenue, Avenue of the Americas, that was made famous by the Sex in the City series. And it was sort of similar in popularity to the soup Nazi in Seinfeld.
Now,
have you made it to the big time on the silver screen in any shows?
You know what? Jay Leno made fun of us because we make something called Drunken Punchki, and he did a little skit about us, and, you know, he was showing basically a bunch of police cars, you know, with the sirens going and driving off after they had some of our Drunken Punchki. So that was pretty funny. You know, that they included us. And we actually were also featured on PBS, the history of, the food history of Chicago. So we've been on a couple wonderful shows.
So you are really sort of an institution, huh?
You could say that. If you want punchki, you come to Delightful Pastries.
Is that right? You're absolutely sure. You don't go anywhere else, right?
That's right.
Anywhere else, their friends,
their cousins, we have to ship them out as well. We ship them out locally here in the Midwest as well. So some people have them for parties. I had some Silicon Valley tycoons order them for their holiday parties. So we've shipped them kind of all over the place.
Oh, isn't that, it's so funny. I'll tell Anne's story since she's not on the air during this interview. When she was expecting our son, everybody, I guess, is supposed to develop a craving. And she developed a craving for cookies that we found at a bakery in the Los Angeles area. They were called alligator cookies. And they were shaped like alligators. It was sort of like a shortbread biscuit recipe, sprinkled with powdered sugar, just like you would a piece of shortbread. And I had an office out there, and the office manager who worked for me out there used to ship them.
What a sweetheart!
Every couple of weeks, he would send us a new shipment of alligator cookies, and so when Anne got back to work making jewelry, she actually made him a silver alligator that he could wear on a chain around his neck.
That's wonderful. That's a story. You guys should make sure you guys, you know, show pictures and you hand it down to the grandkids, because those kind of stories, you know, are kind of what makes everything, you know, kind of the family story, so to speak.
We never found him anywhere else. We tried to go back in history to find about alligator cookies generally, and apparently they must have been unique to this bakery because nobody had ever heard of them.
We asked one place,
and they said, "Oh yes, there's one in the window," but the one in the window was sort of elongated. But imagine it was about the size of a wedding cake.
Wow,
which is not exactly what the kind of cookie that you wanted.
Is a bakery in the Los Angeles still around, or
I don't even remember exactly where it was. It's years since I went there. Monty used to go there, shop there regularly, and I don't really remember exactly where it was. He did all the shopping on our behalf, so and I'm not sure he remembers either.
Yeah.
Well, I think we had better let you go because you're probably starting provisioning for Lent, which is early this year, I think, right?
Yes, it's this year. It's on the 9th of February, if I'm not mistaken, and then the Polish one I think is on the 4th or 5th of February. So it's super Lent is super early this year. So we're already getting the dough ready because we've got to have all the dough, all those little balls of dough ready so we can proof them and fry them and glaze them and stuff them.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We will let you go back to this noble work. And
it was delightful speaking with you. Well, thank you for having me.
We'll be in Chicago for the James Beard Awards about the same time as last year. First Monday in May is when it really is. So we'll have to catch up with you and sample these things for ourselves.
Absolutely. You have a standing invitation to my bakery.
Dobra, thank you so much.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. At least in this cold weather, something to warm the heart. Middle Eastern cooking is experiencing its moments, and it's, again, we keep talking about sunny. It is a sunny cuisine. Here to talk to us about it, his latest book called The Lebanese Cookbook by Hussein Dekmak. We are getting a lot of sounds out of Lebanon and from Lebanese cookbooks, new, published, revived, which is the one I'm looking at now, The Lebanese Cookbook by Hussein Dekmak, that we're going to be interviewing today. It is an updated version of an earlier cookbook, is it, Hussein?
Yeah.
Why is the Lebanese, and in fact the whole Middle Eastern, food scene so hot right now? Everybody wants to taste it, to cook it.
I mean, now, especially these days, you know, people before, they don't know about Lebanese food. So now, it's like getting more and more people known about it, because they're like, every now, since I remember when I came over to London, since 1988, not too many Lebanese restaurants around. So about like four or five of them.
Uh-huh.
Like now, you can go everywhere and every, maybe most, every street you can find a place like a Lebanese restaurant. It's too many this day. So
now,
that's why it's getting, I mean, like, popular more than more.
But why? Is that just because it's all Middle Eastern food?
I mean,
food
not because it's, you know, Lebanese, it's like very healthy and light food. It's not, we don't use a lot of grease or fat on the food. So we only use, when we cook, we use like olive oil, which is like very light and it gives a nice taste to the food.
Uh-huh. But when you go to a Lebanese restaurant, you do get a lot, as I recall. When we went to Al Waha, a restaurant I mentioned to you before we came on the air, I think there were two of us, but we had something like 14 appetizers
on the table
in front of us.
It's a tradition.
Right.
It's a tradition in Lebanon. Like they call it meza.
Meza, right.
Yeah, like similar to tapas. You know, when you go to eat Spanish, you had a tapas.
Yes.
Just like small things, like bits. So, like, you had 14. But if you go to Lebanon to eat, like, you say, I want the meza for two, they will put down, like, about 30, 35.
Yeah, I don't really quite understand what that is. But the owner of the restaurant said, well, we should have brought more people with us.
Yes. No,
I know, but especially for like, you know, especially for people, they don't know about the food. They think it's like small, like the portions, it's not small, you know, it's quite enough. Like for two people, they need maximum like six of them, no more than six. But for people who doesn't know about the food, they think it's like a mess, like tapas, you know, because tapas is small bits, it's not like big portions.
Right.
So they thought like they like to try many different things, so that's why it's like you have like 14 or 15 different things, so it's too much for two people.
Now, is there one ingredient or flavor or a few that are totally unique to Lebanon as opposed to like Syria or any of the other Middle Eastern countries?
It's like if you go for like salad-wise, it's tabbouleh. You know, the parsley, very fine chopped parsley with tomato, onion, fresh mint, olive oil, lemon juice. This is like very traditional Lebanese.
Uh-huh. I like it a lot, of course. And pomegranate,
yeah,
you do
like,
great things with pomegranates.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's also you go to a Moroccan restaurant these days, like, they serve you, like, let's say tabbouleh, but you go different, even, like, Middle Eastern restaurants, they serve you, like, tabbouleh, but the Lebanese way is totally different. You know, the way we make it is totally different.
Uh-huh. Now, we did notice...
Like, in Morocco, let's say, in Morocco, if you have, like, this salad, they put lots of crushed wheat, you know, like couscous.
Uh-huh.
And but tabbouleh is mainly, should be parsley.
Yep, that's what I like. Now, this, I'm sure we will find that recipe in this cookbook, but could you tell me, since there's so many Lebanese restaurants and Lebanese cookbooks on the market, what is so special and particular to your cookbook? Why is yours different?
Mine is different because, you know, it's a very tradition. I choose the recipes of my cookbook, which is very traditional Lebanese and small and easy recipes, which is not complicated for people, Western people, to make.
Uh-huh. Now, what...
That's my only reason.
Could you just pick a few of your favorites from this book and kind of walk our readers through what's in them?
Like, let's say, like, mujadara. It's a lentil and rice dish.
Okay.
Yes. It's a very easy, simple recipe, but it's... When you cook it, and it ends up nice flavor.
Yeah, no, well, which one's that? What? Where is it?
It's the mujadara. It's the lentil and rice.
Okay, well, what else goes into it?
It's just the lentil, rice, and onion. And you put spices, which is like, you put salt, black pepper, and cumin.
Oh, okay. That sounds great.
Now, one of the things, one of the things we noticed is if you don't like lamb... You won't really get to experience the breadth of cuisine in Lebanon. Are there very large flocks of sheep?
No, because Lebanon use they use people. They use most to beef because it's cheap.
Uh-huh.
Because lamb in Lebanon is very expensive.
But you do
lamb gives more taste for the food.
But you do have a lot of lamb
because
recipes.
Of the fat.
Yeah, lamb's my favorite. So, what is more plentiful?
Say it again.
Is there another meat that's more plentiful than lamb?
You have just like in Lebanon, you have a lamb, or you have a beef, or you can like you have a chicken. That's
okay.
The only thing. But what I'm saying is beef because it's cheap. They use it in Lebanon a lot.
Uh huh. Okay, you've got chicken with.
Because
spinach.
If you're gonna buy a lamb. It's double the price.
Really? What are some what other recipes do you like from this book?
I like mostly, I like, it's a melochie, they call it. It's a juice melo. It's a vegetable that looks like a mint.
Now, Peter asked me about that. I never even heard of it. And what is it? It's
never
like
heard
mint.
About it. It's like a mint leaves. You know, they call it melochie.
Uh-huh.
So they call it in English, it's juice melo.
Uh-huh. Is it of the Malay family? What's it taste like?
I mean, it has a special taste to it because this one, you can use lamb, meat, and you can use chicken. So it depends which stock of the meat you're taking with it.
Do the Lebanese like sweets a lot?
Sweet?
Like desserts. Sugar, honey.
Yeah.
Do you eat a lot of
you mean the baklava?
Yeah.
The baklava?
Yeah.
Yeah, I like, but it's too heavy for me.
Right.
Well, I am not a person who likes too much sweets, you know that.
Well, what a laugh then.
I like the... I like it. Most I like the, the pudding, rice pudding.
Right.
Milky, I like milk stuff, the one like you use milk with it. So that's what I like myself.
Well, I know that all the Middle Eastern cultures use a lot of stuffed vegetables. You do too.
Yeah, we use courgette, aubergine, cabbage, tomato, potato, stuffed potato. You can use peppers, which I have a recipe in my book.
Well, that's great. Now, do you need any special equipment? You don't need, like, a couscousier or anything like that?
No, you need, if you do, you need if you do stuffed courgette or stuffed aubergine, there is a special tool you can make the hole. You know, when you make a hole and you stuff the aubergine?
Yeah.
So you use a special tool to do it.
Oh, I never knew that.
Yeah, because, and then you have to be careful when you do that, when you do it, you have to make sure not to crack the aubergine or the courgette. So you need a little bit of experience. You know the apple tools, you know the apple when you, if you know the apple tool, use it to take the seeds out.
Uh-huh. Right.
You know which one, I mean? Yeah. There is some tools like that you can use for the courgette and the aubergine.
Oh, okay. You know, I never, yes. I don't even pay any attention. I guess I cut them lengthwise and scrape the seeds out with a spoon. Anyhow, so you use a lot of za'atar?
Yeah, za'atar is, you know, za'atar we use it in Lebanon, like for breakfast.
Yeah.
And for lunch and for dinner, I guess, right?
Yeah,
but with za'atar mainly it's for, we use it on the, we make like this pizza style. So we mix the za'atar with olive oil and sesame seeds, and we put it on the dough, and then we bake it in the oven.
Well, all of this sounds delicious, and I'm getting very hungry.
Before we go.
Za'atar, you can use it as a dip, you know, like you dip, like you have a pita bread, you dip the bread on the olive oil, and then you dip it on the za'atar and you eat it.
Right. Now, before we conclude, Hussein, you still operate a restaurant in London, correct?
I used to, yeah.
And what's it called and where is it?
He said he used to.
Oh, used to.
I used to, yeah. I used to have a restaurant in Camden Town called Le Mignon.
Okay.
That wasn't French?
No, it's not a French because, you know, Lebanon is a French colony.
Okay.
Yeah? It's I gave it the French name to give a nice, like, good sound and taste, because Le Mignon, it means the cute. And my restaurant is rather small, cozy.
Okay.
So that's why I give that name to it.
Well, there you have it, another show in the bag. We're glad you joined us again today. We hope you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.